Hello and welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. My name is David Yosefan. I am a professor of law at Santa Clara University School of Law in sunny Santa Clara, California. It's been a little while since I recorded an episode in this podcast series. I've been away working on a book. That book is now complete. It's in print and it is available to you. The title of my book is Corporate Friction: How Corporate Law Impedes American Progress and What to Do About It. The book provides a penetrating critique of prevailing corporate governance law in the United States. It provides a critique of the shareholder primacy norm and explicates the adverse consequences that I believe this governance norm has in our society, in our culture, for our nation, and for our economy. After laying out its critique in these various dimensions, the book then adumbrates a set of policy reforms that I believe would improve upon the situation. Specifically, the book makes the case for a reform of our governance standards to require our largest corporations to be managed in the interests of multiple stakeholders and not shareholders alone. It also lays out the possibility of involving non-shareholders in firm governance. For example, by having workers or even community representatives sitting on the boards of our very largest firms. My book was published in May. In late August, Senator Elizabeth Warren filed a corporate governance reform bill in Washington, which she calls the Accountable Capitalism Act, which proposes some of the very reforms that I explore in my book. While I did send the book to Senator Warren's office, I shan't take full credit or blame for the ACA as she has currently filed it and is speaking about it. But I do submit that my book, Corporate Friction, can serve as an introduction to the kinds of arguments that one would need if one were in favor of Warren-style reforms. My book provides a critique of the prevailing system and explains why the kinds of reforms that Warren proposes might be plausible. So if you're interested in the subject generally, or if you're interested in Warren's proposals in particular, you might want to get your hands on a copy of Corporate Friction: How Corporate Law Impedes American Progress and What to Do About It. It's published by Cambridge University Press, 2018. It's available on Amazon in hardcover and in paperback and in digital, Kindle. I hope you enjoy the book. I wrote it for you. As I say, it's been a while since I recorded one of these podcast episodes, but I hope to be putting them out from time to time. So you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And you can follow me on Twitter, at David Yosefan. That's at David Yosefan on Twitter. And I tweet it out whenever I post an episode in this podcast series. Today on the podcast, I'm here to talk about another new book that's out in the area of corporate law, and that is Adam Winkler's book, We the Corporations: How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Professor Winkler is a law professor at UCLA School of Law, and his book, which is out by Liveright Publishing Corporation 2018, is a history of how corporations have been treated with respect to their civil and constitutional rights. It's a history of the development of corporate constitutional and civil rights, from property rights to speech rights to political rights. It starts at the very beginning in the early colonial settlements in the Americas, which were organized as corporations, and runs through the entire history of the United States, settling finally in our contemporary disputes over Hobby Lobby and Citizens United. It's an extremely learned book, extremely well written. It has been incredibly well received. I enjoyed every minute, every page of the book. And I'm just thrilled to have the chance to talk with Adam Winkler and to expose this great book to a broader audience. I know that if you're interested in the subject of corporate social responsibility, you're going to want to get a hand on Professor Winkler's book. You will enjoy it. So I hope you enjoy the conversation that I had with Professor Winkler about his book, We the Corporations. Adam, thanks so much for joining me to talk about your book. Congratulations to you on this really terrific book, and thank you from the legal academic community and the broader reading public for this achievement.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's always wonderful to, having spent so much time on the book, to get a good positive reaction, because you never know what you're going to get when you're writing a book like this.
Well, so let's jump right in with what I take to be the central analytic contribution of the book. There's this idea in our political discourse, and from the at the very highest levels, I think, and even commonly, casually, and in the public conversation about corporations in our society today, that the problem, if people think there is a problem with corporations as they interact with our politics, with our economy, in our society, if people think that there is a problem with the way that the law regards corporations, people speak as if the problem is the problem of corporate personhood, or that the courts have granted corporations the status of personhood, and that regarding corporations as persons in the eyes of the law is what has made them very powerful and has allowed them to benefit from constitutional rights and civil rights in the way that natural persons do, and that that's really the core of the mistake that our legal system has made. But your book really penetrates right through that common perception, and I would just invite you here at the start to describe your analysis of the competing views of corporate personhood and how that has operated in our constitutional jurisprudence.
Well, great. For all the controversy over whether, as Mitt Romney said, corporations are people, my friend, corporate personhood is a pretty misunderstood principle, both in the public debate surrounding Citizens United and in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence more generally. Corporate personhood is actually a long-standing principle of basic business law. And what it means is not that corporations are just like you and me, but that in the eyes of the law, the corporation has its own independent identity. It has its own independent rights and legal duties that are wholly separate and apart from the rights and duties of the people who comprise the corporation, the stockholders or the employees or the creditors. And that's why if you slip and fall at Starbucks, for example, you can't sue the shareholders. You have to sue Starbucks, the legal company. It is its own separate legal person. And while many people blame corporate personhood for Citizens United, if you look at the history of corporate rights, which goes all the way back to the earliest days of America, the first Supreme Court case being decided in 1809, a full half century before the first Supreme Court cases on the rights of women or the rights of African Americans, if you go all the way back, you find that, for the most part, the court has rejected the core tenet of corporate personhood. It has tended to say that corporations have the same rights as people because corporations are made up of people, and the corporation should be able to claim and protect the rights of the members of the corporation, which, if you think about it, is exactly contrary to the corporate and business law principle of corporate personhood, which says that a corporation's rights and duties are wholly separate from the rights and duties of the people who form it.
Yeah, so this is what was so interesting to me about this framing or this insight of yours. It seems that, if I read the book correctly, that the Supreme Court in its jurisprudence in deciding which constitutional provision should apply to corporations, which constitutional protection should apply to corporations, that really there has been, if you want to be charitable, a pendulum that has swung back and forth, and less charitable, kind of a scattershot approach where the court sometimes has treated corporations as persons in their own right and sometimes has penetrated through the idea of corporate personhood to regard corporations as associations of people. And the really interesting insight that you make, from my point of view, is that it's where corporations have been treated as persons, they've actually enjoyed fewer constitutional protections, that the government has had more license to restrict corporations, regulate corporations, control their operations, where the analytic, where the legal analytic framework is to treat the corporation as a person. And that's when the idea of corporate personhood is disregarded and the corporation is treated instead as an association of people, that those are the cases in which corporations have really been able to exploit constitutional protections.
That's right. Since the early 1800s, the Supreme Court, in these corporate rights cases, has usually said not that corporations are people entitled to the same rights as you and me, but that corporations are just associations. They're associations of people, such as shareholders and employees, and those people have rights. For example, in the Hobby Lobby case, the Supreme Court just a couple years ago said that the national chain of craft stores did not have to cover birth control in employee health plans. And the court said because the reason why was because it offended the religious beliefs not of the corporation, but of the company's owners, the Green family. And that's a kind of thinking about the corporation as kind of a pass-through, where it's not its own independent entity with its own independent rights. The question wasn't whether Hobby Lobby had rights as a corporation, even though legally that was the question. But the way the court approached the question was whether the Green family that owned Hobby Lobby, well, what were their rights and how were their religious beliefs offended? And as you know, one of the surprising things that comes up in my research for We the Corporations is that, for the most part, the Supreme Court has treated corporations as associations, as mere pass-throughs, and thus explaining the expansive rights of corporations. But in a few cases, not very many, but a few over the years, the court has really treated the corporation as a separate, independent legal entity. In other words, taking seriously the idea of corporate personhood. And in those few cases, it has tended to rule against expansive rights for corporations. For instance, a case that came out of the early 1900s when Teddy Roosevelt was trying to break up the trusts. He subpoenaed officers of the tobacco companies in an effort to break up the tobacco trust. He wanted those officers to testify before the grand jury. The company, the tobacco corporations, claimed that this was a violation of their Fifth Amendment rights of self-incrimination to require their own officers to testify against them. But the Supreme Court rejected that view and said that when an officer of the company testifies, he is a separate legal person than the corporation itself. The rights and duties of the corporation are different than the rights and duties of the people who are the employees or the shareholders or the members. And so the court said corporations do not have the same right against self-incrimination that individuals have because they were a separate legal person whose rights had to be determined over and above and separate from the rights of the people who comprise the corporation.
And if corporations are merely have corporate personhood or are merely legal persons, then they're not entitled to the human rights, the constitutional rights, the fundamental rights that the Constitution are meant to protect. So
I will just stop you there, because I don't think that's what the court has said, actually. Mm. I think what the court has said in regards to here is that even where the court has said that a corporation might be a person, they've generally said that corporations might be entitled to some rights, even though it's a corporation, even if we think of a corporate person. For instance, property rights. What good would a corporation be if the government could swoop in and take Google's campus and make it a public park without having to pay a dime in just compensation? The businesses and corporations need to have some basic protections for their property rights. And no matter whether the court has said a corporation is a person or is an association, it's generally said that there are at least some basic rights, like rights to property, that corporations would be entitled to, even if they are people. One way I think you might think about this issue, the court doesn't say it in these terms, but I think normatively, if you wanted to think about a way to go about it, you know, we treat under the Constitution minors as people, They have some of the rights of adults, but not all of them. We treat foreign residents who are here legally as people, and they have some rights and not other rights. And even undocumented immigrants have some rights, but not others. We might think of corporations in that kind of way. They're a special kind of person under the law and should be entitled to certain rights of property, but maybe not the same rights of liberty, of personal conscience, of political freedom.
If you try to distinguish cases where the court is using a strong idea of corporate personhood or entityhood and treating the corporation that way, as opposed to penetrating through the corporation and treating it as an association of natural persons and really regarding the rights of the natural persons, I am always struck by, and was struck again in your treatment in the book, you treat the thinness, really, of the Supreme Court's arguments in this area. I'm always struck by the failure in the court's cases to really grapple with corporate theory in any extensive way, or to grapple with these competing visions of the corporation in any thoroughgoing way. It feels as if they pick a theory of the corporation and run with it and kind of assume it and just go with it. And it just differs from so many areas of Supreme Court writing, where you see such careful, nuanced thinking about the legal area in which they're operating. But when it comes to corporations and the theory of the firm that they're working with, they just seem to stipulate it, even where it's contradicting the theory of the firm that had been so important in other cases. Do you read the cases that way, as a kind of ducking of hard corporate theory in the most important cases? And if so, to what do you attribute that?
I think that is the case, especially in recent years. I think that if you go back to the early 1800s, and I talk about the book, that the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations, a case called Bank of the United States versus DeVoe, a pretty much neglected, forgotten case in American law today, but was really, I think, a landmark that was the first Supreme Court case to extend a constitutional right to a business corporation. And the court was very thoughtful in the case about business corporations. Wouldn't necessarily please any scholar or philosopher who was working on corporate personhood, perhaps, but the court really did try to grapple with the fact that it was a corporation involved. And throughout the 1800s, we saw 19th century courts grapple with questions of the nature of the corporation. What we've seen in more recent years, however, is the court's sort of unwillingness to grapple seriously with the nature of the corporation. And especially the court has ignored these principles of corporate personhood under corporate law. We should think about the public rights of a corporation in the context of corporate law, of the legal rules that we have existing that shape and define the nature of the corporation today. And if we have public law rules that are developed without regard to the corporate law rules that structure and organize the corporation, we're likely to have rules that just sort of don't really work very well, or, as you say, are sort of theoretically inconsistent. And that's what we do see, especially since a 1970s case, First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti, an opinion by Lewis Powell, who for various reasons I call the corporation's justice in the book. And Powell wrote that asking whether corporations have free speech rights and things like on things like electoral politics was, he said, the wrong question. The only issue was whether the speech that was going to be financed by corporations would be valuable to the listeners. And by focusing on the listeners' rights rather than the rights of the speaker, the court has kind of really hidden the corporation and made it less and less relevant to the court's decision.
You quote John Dewey as stating that these debates or efforts to distinguish the corporation for legal purposes, for constitutional purposes, as a person in its own right, a legal entity in its own right, separate and distinct from the natural people that comprise it on the one hand, or regarding the corporation as an association of the natural people who comprise it on the other. You quote Dewey as saying that this is an inherently indeterminate debate. And I wonder, do you agree with that assessment? Is it the fact that the Supreme Court has gone back and forth using different models of the corporation for different purposes? It feels incoherent, but is that really the best they can do? In your mind, is one model preferable to the other from from the point of view of evaluating the relationship between core constitutional provisions and corporations, or is it necessary to go back and forth between these two models as the court has, or is there a third approach that might provide greater coherence?
Well, I think Dewey is both right and wrong. I mean, he's right that when it comes down to theoretical models, metaphors that you're using to try to understand something, such as, is a corporation a person, its own independent identity with its own legal rights and duties, or is a corporation an association, a group of natural people who've come together? Whenever you're trying to use that kind of metaphor, it's always going to be, at the end of the day, there's always going to be some wiggle room. We could always debate which one is the proper way to think about it at a particular moment in time. But I do think that courts generally are helped by having some basic foundation, some framework to go about addressing these kinds of questions. And I think if you start by thinking of a corporation as merely an association, merely as a pass-through, and not as its own independent legal entity, I think that helps shape the ultimate answer that you come up with because of that metaphor, because of that way of seeing it. It's not determinative in the sense that there's no wiggle room, but it does really shape the judicial decision making. And what I think is that I don't really talk about this much in the book, because the book is really a work of history that looks to explain rather than to suggest ways in which we might go forward. But I think after writing the book, I think that we should think about corporations as people with their own independent rights under the law, and then ask which kinds of rights the corporate person ought to have, in the same way we say which kind of rights minors should have, or which kind of rights foreign residents who are here legally, what rights should they have? We don't just say they should have all the rights or they should have none of the rights. We make a more nuanced assessment based on the nature of that kind of quote-unquote legal person, their own abilities and skills. And I think if we focused on that question, we'd at least be asking the right question. Should a business corporation have this kind of right? And I think it definitely points to things like corporations having secure property rights, basic due process rights, so their property cannot be taken from them without due process of law. At the same time, I think there is plenty to be said about corporations not being the kinds of entities, at least ordinary business corporations, being the kind of entities that would have religious freedom or religious conscience, which is being used really to manifest the owner's own personal views of some moral issue.
Is it the idea of an approach to analyzing corporate rights that you just described? Would that be your route to deciding Citizens United differently?
Yeah, I think it would. I do think Citizens United was wrongly decided, and I guess I've got a lot of company in that. I think polls show that upwards of 75% of Americans believe that decision is wrongly decided and has done too much to free up corporations and wealthy individuals to spend unlimited amounts of money on election ads. The problems with Citizens United are multiple, and they range from the idea that it's not corrupting to have an independent financed ad to support a candidate. The court said that's just not corrupting. That can't corrupt a candidate, so we'll allow that spending without limits. To the question of corporations having the same speech right as individuals to spend their money to influence elections. You know, for over 100 years in America, we've distinguished between corporate money in elections and the money of other people in elections, and said that corporate money is prohibited. In fact, some of the very first campaign finance laws ever adopted were laws passed in the early 1900s that prohibited corporate contributions to candidates. I tell the story of the major political scandal known as the Great Wall Street Scandal of 1905 that led to that created the huge political firestorm that led to these first campaign finance laws. And even back then, 100 years before Citizens United, there were corporations that challenged those laws in court, saying that they were a violation of the First Amendment, such as brewing companies that wanted to spend money on election ads in the run-up to Prohibition. But courts consistently upheld those laws and said that corporations were different when it comes to political spending. And that started to break down in the 1970s in that decision by Lewis Powell that I mentioned earlier, the corporation's justice, and was really interred finally and completely by the Citizens United case. And so I think Citizens United is wrongly decided, and that there was something, a lot to be said about that 100-year tradition of treating corporate money in elections differently than the money of individuals.
And so are you confident that there's a principled, practical way that you could distinguish a regime that would license the government to restrict corporate spending in political campaigns, but that would still forbid the government from interfering with, say, the New York Times or other other corporations that are engaged in press activities that are you know, using the corporate form, but are engaging in kind of in political speech?
Yeah, and I think that's the regime we've had for up to 100 years up until Citizens United, where we had special rules on corporations, and it was okay, and we still always had special exemptions in those rules for editorials written by newspapers, for instance. Newspapers and websites and the media were never restricted by these laws, never felt any restriction from these laws, and the idea that these laws inherently mean that those outlets can be censored seems to me wrong. We do have a special recognition of the freedom of the press in the First Amendment, which I think when added to basic First Amendment principles, I think provides special protection for those entities, including corporate entities, that are regularly engaged in the business of providing the press for the American people. So it doesn't say there's not going to be hard questions in that. Look, I mean, defining what is the press today is becoming a harder question, seemingly on a daily basis, as what we know to be a journalist breaks down and becomes a different kind of animal. So I think some of these things are in flux, and it's not to say that there's any answer that you can come up with in this field that will solve all the problems, but I do think the idea that the sky is falling and that there's a slippery slope to prohibiting corporate contributions and spending on election to censoring the New York Times is just not supported by 100 years of campaign finance.
Another tremendous contribution, really riveting treatment that you give in this book. As a corporate law scholar myself, I have always wanted to read a decisive kind of treatment about just how it was that the corporate form was used in the earliest colonial efforts in the Americas. You know, how was it that the corporate form was used in the Jamestown colonies? And your book provides that. Anybody who is looking for it, your first chapter now really has that. And I think that that is just a tremendous contribution to the literature. You put it down all in one place in such a compelling, clear way. One of the really interesting arguments that you make is that these corporate entities that founded the earliest, that were the legal foundation for the earliest American colonies or colonies in the Americas, that the corporate charters themselves ultimately served as a model for what would become constitutional debates and ultimately language that would find its way into the United States Constitution. That's just a fascinating historical insight, but also it raises interesting theoretical questions. You know, the other parts of the history that you tell that are so interesting and important to think about, that it was that these early corporations, these colonial corporations, they weren't just corporations. These were for-profit corporations. They were formed to generate profits. And that once these colonies were established, they were trying to attract people to the colonies to work and produce within the colonies. And one of the things that they offered to try to get people to come to the colonies was rights, was liberties, right? And so that it was the provision of individual liberties within these corporate operations that were put in there really to attract people to the colonies. And then these rights become a core piece of American identity and really become a whole part, the core ethos of the revolutionary spirit that would establish the American Republic. It's a brilliant, important story, and I just wanted to invite you to reflect on what you think the consequence of that historical insight is, either for the way that we think about our democracy today, its early foundations in these corporate entities, or in terms of how we should think about corporations operating within our republic today.
One way of thinking about it is to recognize that the corporation and democracy were linked in fundamental ways in the American experience from the very get-go, and that we think about Citizens United as a case where corporations are now influencing politics and thinking about their political rights. But the story is really just the most recent chapter of a much older tale that links corporations and American democracy. And as you say, I talk about in the book how, you know, we think about our founders with regards to the Pilgrims, and they land at Plymouth Rock, and they have their first Thanksgiving, and that's kind of our origin story. And it kind of conveniently overlooks what we also generally learn in school, was that there was a colony before Plymouth, and that was Jamestown, the first permanent English colony. And as you mentioned, it was not a group of people who were coming to America seeking religious liberty to escape tyranny. It was Jamestown. It was named after the king. This was a business corporation that was here to make money, and that the people who came here as colonists were not exactly employees. The world was a little bit different in how these things were structured, but many of them were employees. Many of them were indentured servants of investors, of shareholders who took their share and sent an indentured servant in their place to go and till the fields and whatnot and try to create something in Jamestown. And as you say, some of the earliest elements of democracy, such as the representative democracy in the Jamestown Assembly, which is still widely recognized as the first representative assembly in America, was a corporate affair. It was really a meeting of the members of the corporation, and they were given a measure of self-governance by the headquarters back in London, precisely as a way to attract people to come to the colonies at a time when the colonies were really basically a big death trap, and everyone who kept coming kept dying. It became hard to get people to come here. And then what we saw is that corporate colonies organized around written charters became the really foundation of the early American colonial system. And that the idea of these corporations, that they'd be bound by this written charter that would set out the powers of corporate officers, set out the rights of the members of the corporation, and would list these things on a piece of paper that was binding, really became and transformed over time into our Constitution. And the idea that we would have a written document that would establish the office holders, set out what their powers and duties are, and give the rights of particular members of citizens who are just members of a corporation, and if you will, the United States of America. And so the corporate charters really do have a kind of surprising influence on the shape of our Constitution, and the very idea of a written Constitution.
It's almost as if it was like a mental training or an imaginative training that the early colonists, they were looking to their fundamental rights and responsibilities, not to old world notions of sovereignty through the king, but rather they're seeing their rights in the document, they're seeing their rights in the charter, and that forms the kind of imagination that ultimately results in, you know, in recognizing sovereignty or the embodiment of sovereignty in the ultimately in the American Constitution. One element of that early story that I think is very intriguing. You talk about how this is a for-profit colonial settlement. And you have investors in Europe who are investing in and they're shareholders in the colonial enterprise. It's not owned wholly by the king, right? There are many different investors in Europe. And yet when it comes to the governance of the colony, there is broad in different periods anyway, there's broad participation in the governance of the colonies. So some owners, some people who have shares of an owner, an equity stake in the colony are there operating in the colony. Others are back in Europe. They're not present. But there are workers, there are people who are settling the community, involved in running and producing within the community. And they have a say in the governance of the colony, right? So this is, this gets to the, you know, getting back to the idea of the theory of the corporation in contemporary or modern anyway, you know, in constitutional jurisprudence, when the court is penetrating through the corporate personhood to consider the corporation an association of people, an association of natural people. Well, you know, which people are we talking about in the association? The corporation construed as an association of natural people is an association of who? You know, our Supreme Court today seems to assume that it's an association of the shareholders, right? But that's not written on any tablet or found under any microscope. You know, our nexus of contract theorists today will tell us that the corporation is a nexus or an association of many different kinds of stakeholders, workers, consumers, suppliers, shareholders, creditors. And in these early American corporations, these corporate colonies, there were equity stakeholders, and we understood that these were for-profit entities, but multiple stakeholders were involved in the governance and saw themselves as having an interest in the way the corporation was formed. So I think that history might have something, something to say to us as we think about what our corporations should be doing or what they might do.
That's right. I mean, although the Supreme Court has often thought about a corporation kind of as a pass-through, as we said, as an association of people, where the corporate form itself should be looked past. Although the court has said that, it's really under-theorized the notion of who is the member and who counts as a member and how might that shape the understanding of the rights involved. You know, if you think about the corporate right to political speech, well, a common argument against corporations spending their money on electoral politics is that it imposes that political view upon a group of shareholders that have diverse political perspectives, for which there will be certainly Republicans and Democrats and independents and people all over the map, but yet they're all their money is going to spend on one side of the political spectrum. And there's a sense that when we think about the membership in that way, as a diverse group of political partisans, maybe we don't want to say that corporations have the same free speech right to spend their money as individuals. But this is a problem that goes all the way back. If we go back to the earliest Supreme Court case on the rights of corporations, where the Supreme Court in 1809 said corporations had a right to sue in federal court because their members were citizens who had that right, even back then the court doesn't really address who the members of the corporation were. Were they the directors? Were they the shareholders? If they were the shareholders, there were probably some shareholders that would not be citizens of any state, such as foreign shareholders. How do we think about them? Citizens United said a corporation is an association of citizens. But is a big publicly held corporation for which many of the stocks are held by other corporations or are held by foreign entities or foreign individuals, is that really an association of American citizens that's spending that money, or is it much more diverse than that? And so when we break that down, that notion of membership, we can both find differences in the different kinds of stakeholders, but even among shareholders, it's not clear that the court has really grappled with that notion of membership in any significant and theoretically thoughtful way.
But your approach would be to avoid those problems, at least in the constitutional framework, avoid those problems by simply regarding the corporation as a distinct legal entity, and then it just has what rights and responsibilities we consider to be convenient from a policy perspective, and they don't really depend upon the rights and responsibilities of whatever natural people are associated with it. Do I understand you correctly?
Well, I think I would say maybe I'd add one more layer of complexity, perhaps. I think if you think of a corporation as a person, then you kind of ask, what kind of corporation is this, and what kind of corporation What kind of rights should that kind of corporation have? So, for instance, we might distinguish between a corporation that is not a not-for-profit corporation, such as the NAACP or Planned Parenthood or the NRA, all corporations, but not-for-profit corporations. Mm-hmm. We might distinguish between that kind of corporate person and Exxon Apple or Google or a major for-profit business, and think about those rights in somewhat different terms. And I don't think that we should think about corporations as having only those rights we deem convenient. I think that corporate rights must be more protected than that. That if all corporations only have the rights that lawmakers believe to be convenient, then you're going to see that Planned Parenthood will be put out of business by 17 southern states before you know it. That a corporation like the New York Times would be censored because it only has those rights that we would deem to give it. So I do think there is a sound argument for some basic constitutional protections for corporations. But I think the court has gone too far in extending constitutional rights to corporations and extended to corporations too many of those rights.
Okay, another element of this book that I wanted to ask you about that One of the things that makes this book different than a lot of legal histories is you've got a cast of characters in there that kind of drive the narrative, and that really one could read as driving the history. You give a very prominent place in the book to the lawyers who are standing behind some of these famous and important cases. And, you know, it's really a history of corporate lawyering in the United States, too, from Daniel Webster, or really before Webster, but right through Daniel Webster up to Walter Olson and the contemporary Supreme Court bar. I think it's a very interesting, it's an interesting way to write the book. And you paint the lawyers or frame the lawyers as being very influential in which cases are brought, how they're litigated, what kinds of theories ultimately prevail. And the lawyers are really the kind of the agents of this story as you tell it. I just wanted to invite your reflection on that. Is there a strong theory of history here, or a strong theory of legal process and legal development emphasizing the agency of the lawyers involved, or is this more of a literary conceit as you see it in the execution of the book? Tell us about the emphasis on the lawyers who are litigating these cases.
Well, the reason I emphasize the lawyers in this case is because the corporate rights movement is a different sort of movement than, say, the civil rights movement or the women's rights movement or the gay rights movement. Those are all traditional civil rights movements that involved mobilization of the masses to protest in the streets, to make public demands for equal rights, and to fight in the Supreme Court for decisions like Brown versus Board of Education or Roe versus Wade that protect the rights of minorities or women. The corporate rights movement is similar to the women's rights movement or the civil rights movement in the sense that corporations like women and minorities have been fighting since America's earliest days to win the rights of individuals under the Constitution, even though it's not clear at all that the Constitution was written to protect those rights. But corporations have been fighting, but their fight has been unique. They haven't been out on the streets marching for equal rights. You don't see the Jolly Green Giant or the Michelin Man marching down Main Street with a sign saying, you know, vote for corporate personhood. Corporations are people too. Instead, corporations have fought their battle for equal rights, a remarkably successful battle in which today they have nearly all the same rights as individuals, and certainly all of the rights that corporations would find useful in the Constitution. And they've done that by going and arguing in the Supreme Court exclusively, not by going and arguing in the public. And so these cases, the Supreme Court cases extending these rights to corporations take on even greater significance because these corporations were not engaging in that kind of public advocacy. So every great civil rights civil rights movement requires good lawyers. You think of Thurgood Marshall in civil rights or Ruth Bader Ginsburg in women's rights. And you can't understand those movements without understanding that those lawyers and their advocacy and how they shape their arguments, because you need really good lawyers to come up with the cases, to devise the novel legal theories, to write the briefs and persuade the justices. And corporate rights are really no exception. From the earliest days of America, corporations, unlike traditional civil rights organizations, have been able to hire the best, most expensive lawyers money can buy to bring creative, risky, cutting-edge lawsuits to expand their constitutional rights. So the lawyers do take on a very prominent role in the story of the corporate rights movement.
What do you think of the legal ethics of lawyers engaged in these kinds of suits on behalf of corporations? The ABA has it in its model rules a clear statement that a lawyer is not to be associated with, or a lawyer's advocacy on behalf of a client does not express a lawyer's agreement with the client's point of view or the client's political or moral or business activities. That's a statement that the ABA puts into its model rules about what its view of a client, of a lawyer taking on a client's case, should not be read to express that that the lawyer shares the client's outlook. But yet when we look at these other civil rights movements, constitutional rights movements, like you say, a Thurgood Marshall or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, certainly we associate these lawyers as not just being advocates or hired guns that pursued these legal arguments, but that they were deeply involved, morally committed to these causes. And to the extent that we regard those movements as honorable, crucial, that they become honorable figures. But to the extent that we can that the development of corporate constitutional rights is more controversial and even criticized, as you say, by large swaths of the American public, in what way should we regard then the lawyers or the ethics of the lawyers who are involved in these kinds of cases? In the early part of your book, Daniel Webster seems to, he pops up and he seems to be highly motivated by the very large legal fees that he's drawing from these cases. And a lot of these lawyers seem to be making a lot of money. Maybe they have collateral political or social interests, but they're taking on these big corporate rights cases for the money. You know, and then later in your book, you talk about the development of a really distinct, highly skilled professional Supreme Court bar. And I just want to read the one striking sentence in on page 347 of the book, where you're talking about the development of this this cadre of lawyers. And you say, certainly for most of the elite specialized Supreme Court lawyers, the proverbial game is the thing. That for the contemporary Supreme Court bar, it's the game, it's appearing before the court, it's developing sophisticated arguments, it's winning before the court, it's the game. You know, so maybe it's the money, maybe it's the game, but it's not typically like it is for Marshall or Ginsburg, a deep moral devotion to these issues. So do you have a view of the legal ethics of this? Should we as lawyers, should we as law professors, should we as professionals, should we as citizens hold these lawyers accountable for the causes, for the substance of the cause that they're committing to? Or should we recognize or regard them as just participants in a game and we must evaluate the substance of the issue without impugning the lawyers involved?
Well, certainly there's nothing in today's rules of legal ethics that would prevent corporations from having counsel and even having creative counsel that fought for the rights of corporations. Whether we have a personal ethical problem or we think that's society-wide problematic, I guess we as a society haven't really come to that conclusion. In fact, as you mentioned, we're seeing today the rise of an elite Supreme Court bar of lawyers that's unusually well-trained and influential in the Supreme Court, and they represent primarily business corporations and trade associations that represent businesses. Do we want to hold these lawyers responsible for the rights that they're fighting for? You know, that's been an age-old question in the law. You know, do we want to hold lawyers responsible for the views that they express in a court of law, or do we think of them really as agents of a client principal who is entitled to zealous advocacy on their behalf? I don't think the corporate rights area will be where we'll find ultimate determination of that longstanding controversy. It applies in the context of heinous criminals, terrorists, drug dealers, serial killers, and others. Generally, what we've decided in America is that everyone's entitled to adequate and full representation. But we should recognize, nonetheless, that when we have corporations with the same rights as people, to spend their money to fight Supreme Court cases to win rights, we're going to have a system in which corporations really win because they've got the most money. They've got the willingness to spend that money, to invest it in high-risk litigation to try to seek new legal protections and to fight lawsuits to overturn burdensome regulation. And that's what we've seen over and over and over again. The American judicial system has extended our most fundamental rights to corporations in part because that system is really designed in a way that favors the resource-rich business corporations that have marked American history.
It's interesting. You try to address that ethical issue, and you know, you say, and quite rightly, that there is this long-standing principle that everyone has a right to representation, really, whether it's in the civil or the criminal context. You know, when course private interests are at stake, everyone has a right to counsel if they can afford one, and corporations certainly can. But again, when we even phrase it that way, we use that phrase: everyone has a right to representation. Again, we're put right back into that question of conceptualizing the corporation as an association of people, everyone's, you know, an association of people who have the right to representation, have the right to their interests represented, or is it a distinct legal entity, a distinct legal person? And can, if we are to regard the corporation merely as a distinct legal entity, does that ethical conceit that everyone has a right to a representation include this merely artificial entity, or do we include that in the everyone? And I guess on your general approach, you know, when you talk about treating the corporation as a legal person, for you that doesn't denude it of all legal rights and responsibilities, and so maybe it gets to participate in that ethical conversation as well.
Well, I would think that we wouldn't want to have a system where corporations did not have a right to counsel or did not have a due process right to appear in courts of law and to raise legal challenges to laws that burden them. If they could not, then the next time the FBI wants Apple to open up an iPhone of a suspected terrorist, Apple won't be able to go into court and say no and fight against that. The government will be able to come right in and just order Apple to do it. And what would Apple's recourse be if they can't go to court and say, hey, we have rights to our property and due process, and the government can't come in here and just take our stuff? Yeah. So, I mean, we definitely, I have great sympathy and totally understand where people are coming from when they think corporations should have no rights or only those rights that we decide as a society to give them for public policy purposes. But we have to recognize that there are really serious implications to that approach, and there's probably a really strong reason why the Supreme Court has never gone in that direction. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because the Supreme Court is very business-friendly, although that might be the main reason why mm-hmm. the court has done that, but also legitimate pragmatic concerns that if corporations don't have those basic rights, then no one will invest in corporations, and government power won't be limited in the way that the framers kind of imagined. Mm-hmm. So these are difficult questions, to be sure, and the line drawing is very difficult. But I definitely think that just as corporations should not have all the same rights as you and me, probably shouldn't think about them as having none of the rights mm-hmm. of you and me.
If I can squeeze two more in here, the first question I really want to ask you about, again, the book is so impressive, and so many people have talked about what a pleasure it is to read and how edifying it is. Can you tell us anything about your process as a scholar, as a writer? How did you write this book? What's your approach to doing the research, to conceptualizing the chapters? Anything you want to tell us or any insights you have for scholars, for writers out there, just in terms of your process that we might be able to learn from?
Well, certainly. So I will say the process for this book was I had a basic idea and I just went and started researching, and I knew some of the stories, but frankly, I didn't know half the stories. And there are many chapters in the book that I had no idea about when I started working. That was actually a mistake, I think, if you want to know my advice for future writers. I've written two books, one that wrote very easily, my book about guns, and this book on corporate rights, which took much, much longer. And I think in large part it was because I had a much better sense of what the structure of the book and what every chapter would say on the gun book when I started out than I did on the corporate rights book. And that required me to constantly be rewriting it. And honestly, you know, my book has had great reaction, and if you gave me a chance, I'd rewrite it again today because I see it in different ways. In terms of the actual style of writing, I do find that one of the most rewarding things about my books and the reaction that my books have been getting is that they're very easy to read, that they're good reads, that you enjoy reading them in the way that most you wouldn't expect to read a book written by a legal historian. And I think the key to that is just basically trying to reverse the way scholars write a paragraph. Scholars write a paragraph by beginning with an idea and then supporting that thesis with evidence at the end, right? That's the structure of academic and scholarly arguments. I think if you want to write to a bigger audience, to a popular press, you have to just flip that, which is you start with the evidence, you start with the anecdote, with a person, place, or event, and then use that as a basis for then drawing the conclusion that is what a scholar would say is the hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And by flipping it, you find that the paragraphs become much more readable because they're about people and events, not just about ideas. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the takeaway is an idea, but the paragraph reads as if it's about a person. And I think that scholars can really benefit from doing this. If you want some advice, I like to pick up articles of the New Yorker and break them down. How are they structuring their paragraphs and their sentences? I think that the New Yorker is a particularly good venue for thinking about how to present scholarly and academic ideas in a way that's immensely readable.
That's a great tip. Thank you very much for that one, Adam. All right, then let's close with... I invite your reflection, but I don't insist upon it if you haven't developed your thinking on it yet. But we're talking here just a couple of weeks after Senator Elizabeth Warren made a pretty big news splash in filing a piece of legislation she calls the Accountable Capitalism Act. I think it's the new ACA, if you will, the Accountable Capitalism Act, which would very dramatically restructure corporate governance in the United States for the very largest corporations. In her legislation, the rough of it is that corporations that have revenues of more than $1 billion would be subject to a federal chartering requirement that would require 40% representation of workers on the board of directors, and that would charge corporations with a governance command that would be not limited to pursuing profits for shareholders, but would impose on them responsibilities to govern with an eye towards the interests of multiple stakeholders. The Warren proposal isn't going to be turned into law anytime soon, but it is a formal piece of legislation now that I think makes corporate governance a much more salient feature of our active political conversation. And I wonder if you have any reflection on what kind of guidance your book or your work in this area has, not decisively in terms of saying whether this is a good idea or a bad idea, but in terms of informing how we should be thinking about big proposals for corporate governance reform in our public policy debates today, specifically with reference to Warren's proposal.
Well, like you say, Warren's proposal for a more stakeholder-centered corporate governance regime is unlikely to be adopted anytime soon. But it does reflect an idea that that one way to get around problems like Citizens United and what many people see as the corporate takeover of American democracy is not to change fundamentally the Constitution, as some people have proposed, a constitutional amendment to end corporate rights, or not necessarily to overturn Supreme Court cases so quickly, but to reform corporations and reform corporate law to make corporations more responsible, to make them more diverse in their perspective and responsive to stakeholders other than short-term focused shareholders. If we think about a friend of mine who also works on corporate rights, a professor at Boston College School of Law named Kent Greenfield, has a book coming out in just a month or two called Corporations Are People Too, and They Should Act Like It. And the idea being that, yes, it's true, corporations should have some basic rights under the Constitution, but the answer for mistaken cases like Citizens United that take those rights too far is really reforming corporate law to make them more responsive to the public and to we the people, not just to shareholders. And then when corporations spend their money, it won't necessarily be quite as problematic. So it is an interesting way of going about this, going at the same problem that I'm talking about and identifying in my book, We the Corporations.
Terrific. Well, we'll look forward to Kent's new book and hopefully have him on the podcast. But for now, I just want to thank you for a great conversation, Professor Adam Winkler. His book is We the Corporations, and you can get it on Amazon, and I highly recommend that you do. Thank you so much for taking this time with me, Professor Winkler.
Okay, that's our episode for today. I really enjoyed talking to Professor Winkler. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned. Follow me on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's at DavidYosifon. That's at David Yosifon on Twitter. I will post it when I post a new episode in this podcast series. And consider taking a look at my book, Corporate Friction, How Corporate Law Impedes American Progress and What to Do About It, available on Amazon. Until next time, thank you.